You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284AL Halaiva. It's time for In the Garden, On the Farm.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden, On the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will burrow into and fly away with some insight into wasp behaviors, put the zap on those pesky fruit flies, and take a chance on grape growing in the subtropics. But first, we would like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our generous underwriters.
Aloha, gardener friend Robin.
Yes, aloha to you too. What a great day.
How's it going?
It's wonderful.
Good, good. Yeah. Isn't it great to be in love with plants?
Yes, it's a love affair that's lasted a very long time. Maybe the best one I'll ever have. Who knows?
And it just gets renewed in so many ways. And, you know, the plants are just waiting to inspire us again and again. And when we face problems, but then we have those successes of the plants that are shining, they're blooming, they're fruiting, they're vegetating, and we're going to be talking about overcoming some pest problems today. Right now, I just want to give thanks for the plants in their perfection that continue to inspire me to do my very best for them.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a great show for you today. We're going to jump in with our celestial session. Each and every week, we look to the heavens above for inspiration and guidance on planting and planning our activities in the garden. And today's moon phase is brought to you by me looking at the moon calendar and deciding that it actually was not quite aligned correctly based on our new moon that we just experienced. So I'm going just back to the moon calendar itself and counting out the days from the new moon. And so according to that system, we are in the moon of Kukahi today. Kukahi rose on Kauai at 8:06 a.m. this morning. She'll reach her transit or highest point in the sky at 2:15 p.m. this afternoon and will set at 8:20 p.m. tonight. Only 5% of the moon's beautiful face is illuminated today. The new moon was on Monday. And I want to say, Ikalamai, I've misplaced my Hanalei Watershed Hui calendar, which may concur on the phase that I figured out just from looking at the days of the month, of the Hawaiian moon month. And the Hui Maliola calendar seemed to be one day off to me this time around. The Mana'o is Kukahi is the first of three Ku moons in the first Anahulu or week of the Hawaiian moon phase. And the planting recommendations will be familiar to listeners of the show. We often have these Ku moons showing up because there's three of them. Chances are they're showing up on one of our shows in every few months or so. So we're planting uala, sweet potato, kalo, taro, and mai'a, banana, as our traditional Hawaiian crops today. It would also be good to plant other plants that would benefit from standing upright and firm, or ku. They're given that energy, and with the high winds we get sometimes or other factors, it's good to take some help from the celestial influences in having our plants stand up upright and firm.
Incredible. Well, beautifully, in the biodynamic look at things, today through Saturday, the moon will be in Virgo, an earth sign, making it a good time to work with our rooting plants. And so that falls in quite nicely with the Hawaiian moon for this same period. Virgo is an exceptional constellation in biodynamics because it's enormous. It's huge. The moon actually stays there for 4 days. And the sun spends 45 days in the constellation of Virgo every year, as opposed to the typical month that we're familiar with seeing. Mm. And that is one of the differences in the sidereal or visible zodiac. They don't equate each constellation to a 30-degree section of the sky, and Virgo's one of those big ones. So once in a while we get these times where we really can like go at it. You've got 4 days. You can prep. You can get it all together for our sweet potatoes and taro, and it is planting time. So those are same things that I would be recommending to be planting in the next few days. Sunday and Monday, the moon will be in an unproductive phase. So you can actually just really go at it for those 4 days up until Saturday and take a little break and feel really good about it. And Tuesday next, the moon will be in Scorpio, a water sign, making it a good time to plant some leaf plants. So we're looking at some of our fall leafy crops now that the weather may be cooling down a little as we head towards fall here. We'll see how that works, but... that's what the biodynamic moon looks like for the next week.
Nice. Curious to understand more about these influences, Robin. And so given Virgo is an example of a constellation that the sun is passing through and the moon is passing through, Virgo is made up of stars and maybe planets too, I don't know. Some constellations are made of a combination, or they're always just stars?
No, the planets also take the same path through the constellations that the sun and moon do.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. So, yet these stars that make up Virgo are impossibly far away from each other. And we have identified these constellations by how they look to us. That's really how we've defined them, yes? We see them as a unified group because of their positioning in the sky.
Yes, on a two-dimensional plane, although I want to say that I have not observed pictures in the sky very easily. I'm mostly taking the astronomers and astrologers' word for it. Not a lot of them really pop out to me as the pictures, as they're described in writing and stuff. However, Scorpio is definitely an exception to that rule because it definitely looks like a scorpion up there in the sky. It's quite beautiful. So the fact that Virgo is bigger, I'm honestly just taking their word for it. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of faith in Matthias Thun and the work that he's done. Mm-hmm. And if he has planted root crops successfully during those 4 days, I'm just accepting his data.
Right. Fascinating. I'm looking forward to understanding it more as time goes on, and it's great every week to drop in and just get remarinated in the concept, even if it's the entirety of it is too complex to sort of understand all at one time. It's great to drop in and like you said, take advice from people who know time-tested practices.
Absolutely. It really is just about optimizing our growing and optimizing our gardening and choosing to give our plants the most benevolent energies that we possibly can. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't seem terribly important to us, we don't really have to pay attention to it. But for me, I'm definitely looking for optimal gardening. So.
Right on, Robin. Mm-hmm. This is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. Coming up in this hour, we're going to be speaking with University of Hawaii Cooperative Extension Agent Richard Abisu about all kinds of pest solutions for our gardening and farming efforts. And right now, we're going to drop into which one would you like to do next?
I say we drop into the medicine chest.
Great. Let's drop in. Let's pull it out, dust it off, give thanks that we haven't needed it recently. We're visiting the medicine chest, sometimes out of prevention rather than out of cure. And the inhabitant of the medicine chest this time is a great example of that, a plant that if you use it on a regular basis, it's going to prevent disease. And if you have an acute situation, it's also a go-to plant.
Exactly. And that plant would be noni, or Morinda citrifolia. Is extremely common and grows very, very, very well in our climate here, pretty much effortlessly. Mm-hmm. Makes it a real winner right there. Wildcrafting medicine is, to me, just like a little step ahead of, you know, getting something that is potentially commercially produced. I can't say enough about noni. I live in a noni place where noni grows wild, basically. And everything from using the leaves, nice big leaves, as a plate instead of a paper plate, to juicing the fruit fresh and blending it with some of my other citrus fruits that I have around, such as Noni lemonade. Certainly we all, or most of us, know that the flavor of Noni may be not the most palatable or appealing. Although I have noticed, as people say, if you really need it in your body, it actually tastes quite good.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. It's anti-inflammatory, antibacterial, and antifungal. Mm-hmm. And the plant has been researched to the point where they realize there's 18 healing compounds in the fresh pulp of the fruit. And you can get those by consuming the fruit. In some ways, bee sting or internal use, just grabbing a ripe noni and breaking it open and putting it right on the bee sting can be just really, really effective.
Oh, wow. Want to give mention to a super book on the subject, Noni, the Complete Guide for Consumers and Growers, by our friends Scott Nelson and Craig Elovich. Another one of the beautiful publications from agroforestry.net. Craig's projects are always resplendent with beautiful photography and great research, and this book is no exception. One of the things I loved to read about it was that it came from the Papua New Guinea, Indonesia area, and has been spread. It was one of the canoe plants that was brought here to the Hawaiian Islands, but all throughout the Pacific region. And people started inhabiting that area of Papua New Guinea and Northern Australia 50,000 years ago. And so people may have been using noni for 50,000 years as a very minor food or famine food plant. And I know personally, when I've been low on food and near noni, it becomes more and more palatable and really is an acquired taste, and really interesting and surprising to people that you don't need to wait until it is ripe to actually consume the noni, which is when it develops that sort of cheesy, spicy quality that is unpleasant to some. However, the white but hard fruit can be picked off of the tree, chopped, put into a blender, passed through a paint strainer bag to remove the pulp and the seeds, and the resulting juice has none of the quality. I know I've mentioned this on the show before, but it doesn't have any of that difficult to smell or stomach quality of a ripe noni fruit, and has a lot of those medicinal benefits. And you actually had something to share about that as well, about the changes that occur.
Sure. I think a common way that folks on the island use noni is to collect almost ripe or ripe ones into a glass jar, seal it up, and the noni fruits will weep out a liquid. And technically, that is a fermentation process. So technically, what you're pretty much making is noni wine at that point. Good luck drinking enough of it to get any kind of buzz off of it. But once the noni pulp has been fermented, only 12 of the 18 compounds in it that are healing are still there and available to our bodies. So it doesn't quite have as much going for it, although 12 out of 18 isn't that bad a percentage either. And maybe if it's the most palatable way for you to get noni into your body, it's a decent way to take it. However, I will stress that the whole fresh pulp is definitely where most of the medicine is in that plant.
Mm-hmm. And great thanks to our dearly departed Kumu Lavanohai, who taught me and so many people about processing the ripe or the fresh pulp, whether it be fully ripe or not fully ripe. And also other uses, heating the leaf and putting it on a bruise or a break, making poultice from the green, from the crushed green fruit for contusions, for bruises, for breaks, those sorts of things. And I remember receiving the tidbit from Phyllis down at NTVG some years ago that there was some research that the green fruit actually contains the highest concentration of all of those various biochemical, phytochemical agents that cause anti-cancerous activity, anti-inflammatory, anti-viral and bacterial and all those sorts of good things. And great information again in that publication I mentioned, Noni, the Complete Guide for Consumers and Growers. And so I encourage folks to have a look at that publication if you can get your hands on it. And another interesting thing to consider, although it is very easy to grow, and the ones I've been most successful at growing just came up from a bird planting it or coming up in a garden that has noni, and it's quite easy actually to dig them up and transplant them, grow them up to pot, and then plant them out. It turns out they are very susceptible to root knot nematode. And so very important to check the root system if you're doing a transplant or not to put it into an area that has had other susceptible crops showing damage from root knot nematode, because it's definitely not going to thrive under those conditions.
Interesting. Well, yeah, I have not, and I'm a seed sprouter. I really like sprouting seeds, and I've not had any luck with conscientious seed sprouting on noni, as in collecting seed and planting them and having them grow. However, when I've collected mulch or something that's been under a noni tree and has seeds in it, they do germinate all by themselves with no effort, although they take several months to do so. Mm-hmm. So that it's a long-term germination. I think they don't like the spongy potting mix that probably I was trying in the nursery, but they do better in a more well-drained earth. At any rate, some noni products available on Kauai all over the place. Definitely find them at farmers markets, people making preparations. And there's also realnoni.com, which is a neighbor of mine, the Hawaii Health Ohana, and they have a line of lotions and fruit leathers all made with fresh noni pulp. And the lotion with lavender mixed in is just absolutely, I mean, you thought you had a mosquito bite a minute ago and you put that on there and suddenly it's gone. It really is remarkable, and we certainly could go on and on and on about the virtues of noni. And hopefully we've inspired you to pick out a tree, grow a tree, pick some fruit.
Yeah, and a great example too, Robin, of a plant that you can have great success just growing your own, and then that plant is also supporting small manufacturers of value-added products here in the Hawaiian Islands. And the folks, the Ohana that you mentioned, they've been making their products for years and years and constantly improving, developing, formulating. And it gives me hope that we have these relationships with our community, but the plants and the people are having this relationship that are so mutually beneficial. And noni, what a treasure of a plant, and great that it's not for everyone's palate, because when you need it and there's a tree, you're going to find some fruit on it.
Absolutely. You know, and I love plants. I love all plants. However, I think there's a handful of plants, in my own opinion here, that are holy. They've been with people for so long. They truly are sacred and holy, and I hold noni in that regard myself. It really is a holy plant.
Thank you. Thank you for exalting it in such a way. I feel the same.
Yeah.
So this is In the Garden on the Farm, and we're going to jump into some notable news. Robin has some exciting news and another exciting potential relationship with a plant that we know and love.
Yes, and potentially more another medicinal plant, depending on how you look at it. But I've been doing some reading, and I want to tell everybody that growing grapes in the subtropics is possible. People are doing it, and they're doing it well. In fact, India, in a tropical region, is producing, what is it, something like over 1 million tons of grapes per year?
Yeah, a great new publication that just came to light for me. Ken Love and Robert Paul from the Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers Association and UH Manoa, respectively, just published Growing Grapes in Hawaii, one of the great circulars from UHCTAR, just published in February of 2014. And yeah, they gave that, I'm not sure, but it's a pile.
Yes.
A crazy mountain of fruit being grown in India and other tropical locations.
Indeed. And so in the subtropics here, grapevines are evergreen. They'll grow continuously. And with controlled pruning, it is possible to have 2 to 3 cropping cycles per every 2 years, as determined by temperature and rainfall. So I'll just qualify that this isn't your easy crop. This isn't the one that you just toss in the ground and sort of let it go and, oh my, look, there's some grapes. This is one that you're going to have to work for if you're interested. But as I've been reading, I get really excited about stuff like this. And you know, so if you're looking for a pet project or a pet plant.
Or a niche market.
Or a niche market, indeed. This could be something good to look at. They do recommend that during high rainfall periods, a fungicide of some sort is going to be really, really valuable. So I would suggest perhaps neem, or starting on the prevention side of things, using our beloved LAB serum as a antifungal could be really, really valuable. Although LAB is generally a green growth stimulator, and it doesn't sound like grapes have any trouble putting on green growth. They're very, very good at that. And in fact, in order to get some fruit set, you'll have to practice heavy pruning and removing some of the growing shoots in order to produce grapes. As we know, when we look at tomatoes come to mind right away. If you put a little too much nitrogen on them, you'll get a huge plant with tons of leaves and not really a whole lot in tomatoes. And I think grapes are in that same class. So you're going to have to look into pruning and removing shoots. The recommendation is to grow them on arbors, because what happens is the grape bunches can drop through the ceiling of the arbor and hang well below the foliage and be less susceptible to any kind of fungus or rot of the bunch itself with extra airflow. And it does work out that the varieties that people are growing here that are doing well actually have a very loose bunching habit, so the fruits aren't really jammed together on that bunch of grapes. There is room for air to circulate, which is going to be important. And I don't know, I could mention a few varieties. The Thompson variety, the Flame Seedless variety, and also the Muscadine or Muscat grapes seem to be the ones that are doing the best here. I'm curious what they say in the, do they mention varieties in the CTAR paper?
They sure do, and not only just varieties, but species, several species of grapes that are recommended, and great, just super research and trialing seems to be going on, thanks to Ken Love and his collaborator, Robert Paul at UH Manoa. So very exciting. Grapes, we love them in all different kinds of ways, shapes, and forms. And of course, grapes are awesome for wine. And then there are also other fruits that are similar to grapes, too. So maybe if you're thinking about a winemaking operation, you might want to diversify and grow not only the traditional grapes, but Jabodi Kaba, even harvesting Java. I've had incredible Java plum wine, yes, here on Kauai. And so, yeah, diversifying and putting in those tropical fruit options would be good as well.
Absolutely. And a couple of different places to check out to inspire you on grape growing would be the Pine Island Nursery that's in Florida. Their web address is tropicalfruitnursery.com. And they do ship grape plants to Hawaii in bare root form. And also treesofantiquity.com, which is a California-based place that will also ship bare-rooted grapevines to Hawaii. And certainly the subtropical, you want to look for those subtropical varieties and choose your variety very, very carefully.
Right now I'd like to feature a website that I think our listeners might enjoy, and this is the cabi.org. This is cabi.org. This was a website that came to my attention doing research for our next segment on pests, and they have a lot of information. It's a huge portal. CABI, I'm not sure how to pronounce it exactly, is a major intergovernmental nonprofit organization. Their mission, to improve people's lives worldwide by providing information and applying scientific expertise to solve problems in agriculture and the environment. I'm familiar with them from some of their publications. They have really very well scientifically documented or researched books on agriculture. I have a couple of books on seed science, as well as they have tropical crop books that focus in. The one I have is on taro, sweet potatoes, and yams. And they don't have a lot of publications that are free to view on the internet, but their books are of the highest quality. And specifically, one of the resources available is the Invasive Species Compendium, and that can be found at cabi.org/ISC. And it's a great encyclopedia of invasive species and area of origin, what kinds of problems they're creating, as well as biocontrol and other control methods for plants and insects. And definitely a great resource that I know I'm going to go back to and has now become part of my toolkit for doing research on some of our troublesome plants and insect that we have here in Hawaii. And that's going to blend us right into our next segment. You're listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea. This is In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts Paul and Robin. And right now we're going to dive into pest problems solved. This month we're focusing in on the Annona family, and we're joined by a special guest, Richard Abisu. He is Kauai Cooperative Extension Service Agent with the University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources. He was educated in entomology from UH Manoa, major education programs in fruits, nuts, and coffee and landscaping have been his purview. His current projects include low-chill peach variety trial, breadfruit pruning trial, and fruit fly suppression education. Previous projects included master gardener training and early childhood education garden projects. Richard, it's great to have you, and you sure have all the skills we love to dialogue with here on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So today, the main thing on my mind is the Annona seed wasp, because we're talking about pest problems of our Annona plants. And I have personally seen this pest in my orchard. And I know that's kind of an oddball thing, because it's really only been documented on the Big Island and Oahu. So I'm wondering if you can let me know, what is my course of action? What's the best thing for me to do with this infested fruit?
Well, the best thing, number one, is to get rid of all infested fruits that you think might have the wasp. And don't just leave it on the farm. Actually get rid of it or compost it if you can. The second, probably more practical approach is to bag your fruits. I know that's difficult, especially if you have large trees, but I don't think any pesticides would be effective, because once the wasp lays her eggs inside the seed, there's almost no way to get a pesticide in there, even if you had one that you could use. As far as I know, looking in the literature, there are not real effective biological controls for this pest. Because the egg is laid in the seed, it's difficult for any kind of another wasp, say, to get down into the seed. So from what I understand, the female wasp will lay her egg in the seed of the Annona when it's about 1.5 to 2 inch diameter. So she can actually reach, you know, her ovipositor can reach the seed. when the fruits get a little bit larger than that, she probably won't be able to lay her eggs in the seeds because she won't be able to reach them, those seeds. So the larger fruits, you probably don't have too much damage. At least the eggs won't be in the seeds. But it's still a good idea to protect your fruits. If you're going to have fruit fly problems, you could bag the fruits for fruit fly prevention.
So, Richard, in terms of timing, it sounds like you got to get on this bagging pretty early. And a couple of weeks ago, we focused in on the pollination of Annona. Is it sort of a 1-2 process where you'd bag straight away? Or would you wait a little while because the flower is so delicate during the flowering stage that it's just going to pop off if you try to put a bag on it too soon?
I think so. If you are hand pollinating, you might want to do it at the same time. But if you're letting, let's say, the sap beetles or whatever pollinate your Annona flowers, you might want to wait till your fruits are what we call fruit set, where you actually have a developing fruit before you bag that.
And have your observations been similar to Robin, that you do see it here on Kauai, or has she got an unusual manifestation of this particular pest?
I have never seen it myself, but I have had, I spoke with a farmer in Kilauea who, he said he has it, and I emailed the Hawaii Department of Agriculture on Oahu, and the fellow there who keeps track of all the insects in Hawaii said it has never been recorded from Kauai. So if Robin wants to bring her wasp over, we can send it over to Oahu.
Uh-huh. So I'd bring it over to you guys there at the Extension office?
Yes, you could bring it over to me or the Hawaii Department of Agriculture in Pualoke.
Well, good. I think I'm going to do that the next time I find one.
So beyond that, what other sorts of problems from a pest and disease standpoint might we likely to be facing with Annona fruit?
Well, I think the next major pest will be fruit flies. I'm guessing it would be the oriental fruit fly in low elevations and maybe guys on the Big Island and Maui in higher elevations. Maybe they get the Mediterranean fruit fly. But for most of us on Kauai, unless you're up in Kokei, I would expect the oriental fruit fly to be the major tropical fruit pest.
And is it a considerable loss in terms of the production from that? From those pests?
No, not so much loss of production, but then you get unmarketable fruits. I mean, nobody wants to eat a fruit with fruit fly maggots in it. So, and the fruit fly, you can probably notice the puncture that the female lays her eggs, whereas the Annona seed wasp, from what I understand, is difficult to detect the puncture because she lays her eggs when the fruits are relatively small. What you do find is the holes and the tunnels when the wasp emerges from the fruit, and that could be a source of entry for things like bacteria and, you know, fruit rotting organisms.
Yeah, that's interesting. I actually wondered, but you saying that the female wasp of the Annona seed wasp lays her eggs when the fruits are very young, I wondered if it was the adult that was tunneling deeper into the fruit to get to the seed. But now I realize that tunnel is the emerging newborn wasp.
Yes, that's correct.
And of course, fruit flies are a major problem for so many of the fruits that we're growing here in the Hawaiian Islands. And so solutions there are going to benefit, of course, not just people who are growing members of Annona, but so many other fruits as well. And it's great that the Cooperative Extension Service has done a lot of focus and research on how to control these pests.
Yeah, and we were just talking about the farm fair that's coming up. I'm going to be at the farm fair talking about fruit fly control. And essentially, it's a three-part technique. One, of course, is to get rid of the infested fruits and vegetables. That way you eliminate the breeding population. The second one, they have a bait spray that's essentially a protein bait that has an insecticide in it. The common one they call GF120 has spinosad in it, which organic farmers can use. And then the third technique is a lure that attracts the male flies. It only attracts males. So you put that in a trap, and hopefully you catch the males before they mate and reduce the fruit fly population. It's a slow, long process, but it's just about all we have other than bagging the fruits.
Right. We're speaking with Richard Ibisu from the Cooperative Extension Service of UH Manoa and stationed here on Kauai. And Richard, as far as the fruit flies go, wondering how important it is to be partnering with our neighbors. We may be doing control in our area, but if our neighbors are leaving their fruits to rot on the ground, how much effect can we really make unless we're making a landscape-level approach?
That's a real difficult problem because, as you mentioned, if you do an area-wide control where several farms or gardeners are all participating, you have a better chance of reducing the fruit fly population. And it's real discouraging when you are doing the fruit fly control techniques and you look over the hedge and you see your neighbor's mangoes all on the ground. And, you know, it's just a breeding site. So unless you can convince your surrounding farms or neighbors to help clean up, at least take the infested fruits and, you know, dispose of them, even if they don't use the traps and the bait sprays, at least they're not having the fruits laying on the ground.
I'm curious, Richard. I know I've heard lots of rumors of how many different kinds of fruit flies live here on Kauai with us, how many different species. And could you clear up my misunderstanding? I mean, I've heard estimates of, like, people say there's 15 different kinds of fruit flies. Or I'm curious how many are actually documented here.
We have four of what we call the Tephrididae fruit flies. Tephrididae is the family of fruit flies, and that includes the oriental fruit fly, which is our major tropical fruit pest. We have the melon fly, which infests vegetables like cucumbers, zucchini, squash, etc. We do have the Mediterranean fruit fly, which is mostly a problem in fruits in high elevations. So things like peaches or plums. On Maui, they have the persimmons up on the slopes in Kula. So their major problem was the Mediterranean fruit fly. And the fourth one is called the Solanaceous fruit fly, or sometimes the Malaysian fruit fly. That fly will be a pest on solanaceous crops such as tomatoes, peppers, and eggplant. It's not considered a major pest compared to like the oriental fruit fly. But some people also call fruit flies what we call vinegar flies, and these are what they call Drosophila. And so sometimes you see those around compost piles. Or let's say in your kitchen, if you have a trash can, you know, you save your kitchen scraps and stuff. Sometimes you see those flies. They're usually very small, kind of brownish or black. But sometimes those are referred to as fruit flies also.
Those are the ones that are often cloudy. There's a cloud of them near fruit that's decomposing.
Yes, that's most likely the Drosophila vinegar flies.
And do they actually cause damage to unblemished fruit, or is it only fruit that has already been damaged that they can enter?
Yeah, they're mostly kind of like decomposers. When your fruits are overripe, that's when they tend to show up.
And are these the ones that potentially have been seeing massive clouds of recently in this windless weather that's been happening off and on?
You might. But those flies are attracted to, either decaying fruits or vegetation. What you might see just as you're walking down the road and you see these fungal gnats, sometimes those things will come up after a heavy rain.
I was very interested in a recent workshop or conference, a small fruit growers conference that occurred at at Kauai Community College, and I'm assuming you were there. Perhaps you were a presenter. This was maybe in the last 6 months. Is this ringing a bell for you?
Yes, I coordinated that conference. I believe that was the end of May, and I brought over some of the CETAR speakers to address fruit problems, things like plants, plant diseases, and pineapple. Again, focus on the pest problems, and we had a speaker on papaya pests. And Dr. Mark Nickum was our fruit research in Hilo, but he recently left the college. So, but I did do a talk on the fruit flies as well. Yes, I did coordinate that conference.
Great. Sounds, sorry I missed it. I hope that you'll consider repeating it in future years to come. I'm wondering about the export market as we're thinking about how we can revitalize our agricultural community here on the island and in the Hawaiian Islands. How are we doing in terms of exporting fruits, and how much are our pest and disease problems limiting factors of that?
Well, if you want to ship fruits out of Hawaii, it has to be disinfested. And you're probably familiar, we have a disinfestation facility down by, in Ahukini, down by the airport, that's been closed for, at least 10 years. It was processing papayas, fresh papayas, to the mainland, but since it's been closed, nothing has been going out. So right now in the state of Hawaii, you can ship fruits and vegetables to the outer islands without having the disinfestation facility. But then the cost of transportation is another factor. So it has to be, cost effective. So you probably have to have something in volume to make up for the cost.
Right.
And what exactly are we disinfesting out of our, say, papayas that are being shipped out?
The major problem was the fruit flies. And what they did was they heated the bins of papayas, what they call vapor heat. It's kind of like almost steam, but the idea is to raise the temperature to kill the fruit flies but not cook the fruit. And, of course, sometimes they have scale problems on the fruits themselves, and those would probably be killed by the temperature.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Richard Ibisu from the County Extension Office. He helps people overcome their problems, challenges with production and growing well. So helping people to have good success growing fruits and vegetables here on Kauai and in the Hawaiian Islands. And very interested in some of the things that we mentioned in the short introduction I gave for you. You're doing some low-chill peach variety trials. I would imagine you're probably keeping the location of that highly secret, because peaches are so highly desired here anywhere, really, but in Hawaii, certainly when they come into Safeway or some of the big box stores that bring in peaches, you see a great interest in that particular fruit. The idea that we could grow them here in the subtropics, very exciting. How's that going?
Not well. We are having a tough time. Even though it's called a low-chill peach variety, it still will perform better with cool temperatures. And I have cooperators, different parts of the island. The elevation is not as high as, let's say, up in Kauai. And we're finding out it needs a lot of water. We're anticipating we're going to get some fruit fly pests and maybe some scale insects, things like that. But It's been about 2 years in the ground, and unfortunately, we're not getting too many fruits.
But vegetative growth is well enough. Maybe it's just you need a really nice mature tree.
That's possible. Other cooperators in the other islands say they normally get fruits after about 3 years. So maybe next year we'll get a little bit more. We have seen flowers, but not a whole lot of fruits. And we're losing our leaf, our foliage. So we see a lot of sticks on the plants rather than branches full of leaves. So we're hoping it gets better.
Well, let's mention another plant that maybe we could say is much better suited here in Hawaii, and that would be the breadfruit that you're working on. And people do have a lot of sort of a wide variation of opinion on how do you correctly prune a breadfruit tree, how much is too much, and how does it affect the yield. So great to have some insight from you on that as well.
Yes, that's one of the things. I've started this project communicating with Dr. Diane Ragone over at the NTBG, and I got some Ma'afala breadfruit from her, and it's a little bit more compact than what we consider the Hawaiian ulu, which grows, if you don't prune it, it'll just grow for, 20, 30 feet or so. And so what I did was I topped the breadfruit about maybe 7 feet tall, and so the highest lateral branch should be as tall as maybe 7 feet or a little bit more. So I'm going to try and take some fruit data. I want to harvest, weigh the fruits, and see how much one tree can produce. Because I think one of the limiting factors for breadfruit is when it gets too tall, it gets difficult to harvest, or sometimes even dangerous when people are climbing up or on ladders. So I'm hoping we can get some yield data as well as, you know, what height should be optimum for pruning. I only have that one variety, though, so I cannot say what would happen for some of the other breadfruit varieties.
No.
You know, just to go back for a moment, Richard, to the wasp conversation, if you don't mind. You know, I have always considered wasps generally to be beneficials, I guess knowing all about these parasitic wasps. But I know there's been some really bad ones, too, like the Erythrina gall wasp that really took out our willy-willy trees. And it just kind of raises a question for me about biological controls, and I see that a lot of times these wasps are super specific to one pest, and I wonder just kind of what your sense is on how effective biological controls are, how safe they are in the long term, because we know that sometimes in the tropics something shows up that only likes one thing to eat but then suddenly finds a whole bunch of other things that it also likes. And I was just curious if you could describe to us a little bit of the difference of between the good wasps and the bad wasps, so to speak.
Yeah, most of the biological control projects now is done by the Department of Agriculture. And they do extensive, they screen it because, like you said, they want the biological control wasps to only attack one pest, if possible. That way it's not a problem on non-target insects. Sometimes it crosses over. Like you said, you know, one wasp might, let's say, control aphids and maybe white flies or something like that. But most of the ones that they are introduced by the government, they do extensive screening, because you heard how some of the early biological control projects didn't work well, like the mongoose and things like that. But one of the problems we have here in Hawaii is the farmers and gardeners cannot just go out and purchase the biological control agents. And it's discouraged to, the Department of Agriculture doesn't want us to go on the internet and buy ladybugs and bring them to Hawaii, et cetera. because you might be bringing in hitchhikers that's, you know, coming in with the ladybugs or the wasp larva or things like that. But overall, I think it's a effective control method. It's not going to eradicate our pests, but as part of a control, what do we call integrated pest management, I think it has its place.
One of the great things about having someone like you who've been in your position for as long as you have is you have that memory of all the things that have been tried during the length of your career. And we often hear from people, I'm going to start a ladybug farm because you can't get them here. Like you say, you can't import them. Have you ever known a Hawaii-based ladybug farm that grew the local ladybugs?
No, not ladybugs. When I was in school at Manoa, we had a grad student who I think she was rearing whiteflies, and she had the, I guess there was some kind of a wasp, and she was trying to rear the wasps on the whiteflies. But as you know, it's kind of difficult to rear your host. Let's say if you wanted to get ladybugs, then you have to rear aphids to feed the ladybugs, and it's not that easy, especially when your population crashes. But I have not heard of anybody in Hawaii trying to rear ladybugs.
Well, hopefully somebody will give it a shot at some point. We sure love to see when they naturally show up to control our aphid problems. Right now we're going to jump into our final segment of the show, and yes, and grateful that you'll join us in a bit of discussion on our Secrets of the Soil Builder topic. Today we're talking about milky spore disease. Milky spore disease is a soil-borne bacteria. I won't try the Latin name because it's kind of confusing to me how to pronounce it, but it causes a disease in grubs of Japanese rose beetle and oriental beetles, and it's often used with great success, often in the turf industry, but also in organic gardening and farming to some extent. And I keep hearing about people saying, well, this is an option. We have rose beetles here, and why aren't we using this solution? It's expensive. It takes a while to inoculate. And we did some research and discovered some important it all comes down to the details. Oftentimes, and while it would be nice to use this biocontrol, which is reported to be harmless to the environment, to pets, to human health, etc., it turns out that it specifically targets the Japanese rose beetle as well as a beetle called the Oriental beetle. And however, we have the Chinese rose beetle, not the Japanese, here in Hawaii. And it turns out that it doesn't affect the Chinese rose beetle a bit. So it would be a mismatch, certainly, to address a Chinese rose beetle problem. So again, getting back to that importance of identifying your target pest before you take measures. Are ways to control Chinese rose beetle, just to back up and say, we do have the Oriental beetle, one of the two beetles that it does address. However, I asked you before, earlier on, Richard, if you were familiar with this as a significant pest and it didn't hit your radar. So while we have it, it doesn't seem to be something people are trying to control, the Oriental beetle.
No, I think our biggest beetle problem would be the Chinese rose beetle. And you're right, we don't have the Japanese beetle in Hawaii. And I just wanted to say, you know, there are these lures for the Japanese beetle. So if anybody in Hawaii purchases this lure and they catch something, please let me know, because we're not supposed to have the Japanese beetle in Hawaii. By far, the Chinese rose beetle is our biggest beetle pest because it has a wide host range. And it's not just roses, but, you know, vegetables and ornamental plants as well. I'd be curious to see the test that, you know, you mentioned about milky spore not working on the Chinese rose beetle larva, because it, for one thing, it's not easy to find where the larva are, you know, in the soil. So if you have some kind of a reference for that study, I'd be interested in it.
Well, I have to say it wasn't a specific study that concluded that it did not. However, I am referring to a website I mentioned earlier in the show, which is CABI, CABI.org, and it is specifically their Invasive Species Compendium. It has great information on insect and plant invasive species, and in reviewing the biocontrol methods for these three beetles in question, Japanese, Chinese, and Oriental, the Japanese and Oriental do list milky spore as a limiting agent. However, the Chinese beetle does not list it, and they've obviously done exhaustive research on this global agricultural pest. So it's a conclusion I'm reaching that in the research I've done, that there's nothing that says you can control them with that particular disease.
Mm, okay.
However, it is suggested that there's potentially, there is a green muscardine fungus, which is effective at killing the Chinese rose beetle. There are potentially nematodes that could be used to limit them as well, not to be confused with the parasitic nematodes that harm plants here in Hawaii, but other kinds of nematodes. But again, that would probably be an introduction or at least a novel multiplication of nematodes that hasn't been done in Hawaii, and we'd have to look to the Department of Agriculture, the State Department of Ag, to see if any work is being done in that area or if they've considered that. And in addition to these options, there are also some really low-tech ways and non-toxic ways to control the Chinese rose beetle, and one of them would be through lights. Do you have any experience with that?
Not personal experience, but I have spoken with people who have tried using lights, and you probably notice the plants that are grown under streetlights, they have less damage from the Chinese rose beetle than plants grown in the dark. And I'm not quite sure if the beetles are attracted to the light and therefore leave the plants alone, or if the light confuses them and they think it's daytime and so they don't feed on those plants. But yes, the lights do seem to help.
Seem to be very effective in some research I was looking at, over 90% reduction in damage to a young cacao orchard, which can be decimated by the Chinese rose beetle. So, and yet, movable lights, it is a significant investment. And another option that I've seen effective is the wire cage around trees with shade cloth on the wire. And so this presenting just a physical barrier for the Chinese rose beetle that are flying in horizontally, and if they can't get to the tree, they're not going to be dropping to the ground and doing their life cycle right there in the soil. So another low-tech, non-toxic option for folks who are having that particular problem.
Yes, and we also noticed some of these fruit trees, when they get to be, you know, a certain height, they seem to tolerate the beetle damage. It's usually when they're quite young, and then if every leaf is decimated by the beetles and the plant struggles. But as it gets older, you know, the young leaves might be the favorite for the beetles, but then usually the older plants can tolerate the damage.
Yes, I've seen that myself too. Well, Richard, it has just been such a pleasure having you on the show with us today and your mana'o and experience here in Kauai agriculture. We thank you so much for taking a little time to talk with us. Our listeners are interested in contacting you. We've got a couple contacts for you.
Yes, the office number there is 274-3475, and you can also reach Richard at rebesu, which is R-E-B-E-S-U at hawaii.edu. Again, Richard, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Aloha.
Aloha.
This has been In the Garden on the Farm with your host, Paul and Robin. We'd like to thank our special guest on the show today, Richard Ebisu. You can contact him at 274 3475 or through his email, ribesu, E-B-E-S-U, at hawaii.edu. And that's it for the show today. We want to invite you to tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha.
Aloha.